the job at Michael Hayes. And he got it. And 15 years later, he's written a book about the Khmer Rouge, the tribunal, the search for justice, as we're all well versed in, and a lot of people here are well versed in. So without further ado, I shall introduce Mr. Robert Carmichael.
Thanks, thanks, Luke, for those kind words. Thanks, everyone, for coming. As I look out, there's quite a lot of familiar faces. Thank you all for coming tonight. For those who aren't the familiar faces, I should probably tell you a little bit about me. Not a lot about me, just a little bit. My involvement with Cambodia. So I'm a South African. I was born and brought up in Cape Town. And I grew up in South Africa in the 70s and 80s. Which is a time of a lot of turmoil in South Africa, as everyone knows. My first visit to Cambodia was 2001. I'd moved here, and the idea was to come and work here as a journalist. And Michael Hayes, whom Luke mentioned just now, was at that time the owner and publisher of the Phnom Penh Post. And he offered me a job as managing editor, which I took, and I stayed for 2 years. And I left in mid-2003. By the time I left, Cambodia and the United Nations, the Cambodian government and the United Nations had signed the agreement to set up the tribunal, the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, which is formally known as the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia. I remember leaving in 2003, and the agreement had just been signed. And I left, and I remember flying out of Cambodia and just thinking to myself, well, I understand a fair amount of what happened under Democratic Kampuchea, the 75 to 79 years. But I wasn't quite clear why it had all happened. But I didn't expect to come back to Cambodia. And I just assumed that that would be that. It'd be one of these sort of mysteries. I ended up coming back in 2009 because Doik's trial got underway. And I thought to myself, this would be an excellent opportunity for me to try and have some of those questions answered that I had sort of failed to understand during my 2 years here. So that was my rationale for coming back at the beginning of 2009. I've been here since then. And I guess the point of coming back in early 2009 is that that's when I met two of the key people in the book, Martine Lefevre and her daughter, Neri Uk. And that's where they sort of fitted in terms of my life in Cambodia and my understanding of what happened. And their story is a large part of the book. What I'll do quickly is just give you a rundown of, as these pictures sort of flash behind me, the title of the book is When Clouds Fell from the Sky, and the subtitle is A Disappearance, A Daughter's Search, and Cambodia's First War Criminal. The title of the book is worth explaining because it's probably unfamiliar to a lot of people. About a year ago, I spoke to Yuk Chang, as I have done many times over the years researching the book. And I asked him for a number of, we were batting back and forth, like a number of phrases that might, the people used to characterize that time under Democratic Kampuchea. And Yuk told me of this one phrase, which translated means the time when the clouds fell from the sky. And he explained the meaning behind it. And the meaning was that the Khmer Rouge viewed urban Cambodians as arrogant, as above the peasants, in the same way that clouds were above the land. And as individualistic, and that was anathema to the Khmer Rouge. And So Yuk told me they promised they would bring them down to earth, and indeed they did. The Khmer Rouge war on urban Cambodians was a significant part of their destruction of Cambodia. So that explains the title. The subtitle, The Disappearance, referred to the loved one of Martine and Neri, whom I met in early 2009. And his name was Uk Ket. He was a young Cambodian diplomat, and he'd been recalled in 1977, not expecting anything more terrible than having to work in rice fields for a few months to cure his bourgeois attitude, he came back, and they never heard from him again. So Ket is the disappearance in all of this. The daughter's search is his daughter, Neri, who you can see here, testifying against Doik in 2009. She's the daughter in this, and she's really the central character for me in the book, in as much as she spent a lot of her life trying to first fathoming what had happened to her father, and then trying to accept it and get some justice for him. There are a couple of other characters too. One of them, of course, is Comrade Doik himself. Doik was, for those who maybe aren't familiar, was the head of S21 prison. And he was the first person to go on trial at the Khmeru Tribunal, and he's the reason I came back to watch that trial. And then what I also wanted to have in there was obviously a Cambodian angle, because Martine and Neri, they're both French. They married into Cambodian family, but they didn't come to Cambodia for the first time until 91, so they were very unfamiliar with a lot of it. But Ket, the young diplomat, his cousin, he grew up with in Phnom Penh. She was a part of the story too, and she stayed in Cambodia. So her story in this book explains a fair amount about what happened to ordinary Cambodians in that time. So what I took, I wanted to take five lives, five decades, and use those to try and portray what had happened to Cambodia in that time. So the other thing that's worth mentioning, by the way, on the cover art, and you'll see the cover of the books are over there, of course. Every so often, the cover will flash up here. And the cover is by a painter called Van Nat, who survived S21. He was put to work by Doik because Van Nat had skills Doik felt were useful. Van Nat was put to work painting images of Pol Pot, doing some sculpting, and wasn't killed, unlike most of the other people of S21. So Van Nat died a few years ago, and his painting that we've used on the cover is called Dragged into Tul Slang, and it shows a collection of prisoners being taken into Tul Slang. One of the things I like about the painting, and I've no idea if it was deliberate, but I suspect it was that the faces of the prisoners are individual. You can see that they are individual humans. The faces of the Khmer Rouge guards are obscured or otherwise anonymous. And in that way, I think Van Nat was subtly telling people that this was his response to the Khmer Rouge's destruction of the individual, that actually individuals do count. And of course, under the Khmer Rouge, they didn't count at all. So that's a bit of a brief introduction into the cover, into the book, into the structure that I try to put into it. And people have asked me, so why write a book about this? What are you trying to achieve by doing this? One of the things that interests me, and has always interested me since I can remember, is how humankind can survive the most extraordinary, extreme situations. Whether, for example, in my grandfather's case, he was in the trenches in the First World War and survived that. Whether it's the Cambodian people under the Khmer Rouge, whether it's the siege of Stalingrad, the concentration camps in World War II. What's astonishing is humankind's capacity for endurance. So one of the things I wanted to get across in the book was that. Another thing that is probably more subtle in terms of the book itself and the message is how easy it is to destroy and how hard it is to create. And we don't have to look too far today to see destruction that goes on in the name of political belief or in the Middle East, there's plenty of that going on right now, the destruction of cultural heritage, for example. So one of the more subtle messages, I guess, is that message that to destroy is easy and to create is difficult. And certainly the Khmer Rouge did a phenomenal job destroying what was Cambodia in quite a short space of time. And a third interest that I have is how post-conflict societies move on, and that's probably in large part because I'm South African, and the apartheid system was eventually driven to overthrown and driven to collapse, all for the better, and South Africa had its truth and reconciliation process, and that was South Africa's way of trying to move on from its evil past. Cambodia had its own mechanism, and we'll get to that in a bit. Something else that's worth mentioning is that what I wanted to achieve with the book was to write something that would appeal to an overseas audience. And the reason for that is partly because there's so many more tourists coming to Cambodia these days. And people coming to Cambodia, unlike most of you, don't know a lot about it. I mean, they know about Angkor Wat, which is why they're coming here. And they know a little bit that, you know, in the 70s, Cambodia went through a terrible time and a lot of people died and there was this guy called Pol Pot. But other than that, they don't really know much. And I figured that actually a book that put into some human context and used as a bridge a family that were French but had a very strong connection to Cambodia could help connect this gap between a Western culture that struggles to comprehend Cambodia and the Cambodian experience. So that was a key part of my reason for taking the stories of Martine and Neri and weaving them in through Martine's husband, Neri's dad, who was Cambodian, and then through his family, which was largely destroyed during the Khmer Rouge period as well. What briefly, it's worth saying that what drew me to Martin and Neri's story, I first met them in early 2009. I'd just come back, and I'd come back to cover the trial of Doig. And I met them quite by accident at breakfast down on the river at La Crozette restaurant. They happened to be at the next table. We got chatting. They found out I was a journalist. I assumed they were tourists. I was wrong, of course. And they told me why they were here. And what struck me about their story was, particularly, was that theirs was a story of disappearance and loss. And that's extraordinarily common in Cambodia. So many millions of people had loved ones who disappeared. And there are no bodies, there are no graves, there's nothing left of them. They are as dust. And it was the same for Neri and Martin. And it struck me that the difficulties they'd had in getting through that, and this thing that psychologists call ambiguous loss, which is where somebody disappears, and to all intents and purposes that they're dead, but just in the back of your mind, there's always this hope that just perhaps one day they'll come back, and that was certainly Neri's hope for many, many years, and eventually she accepted quite late on that her dad was dead and wasn't going to come back. So that I thought was a useful way to, again, to bridge this gap between the Cambodian experience and their experience in that context was very representative of a lot of Cambodians. Even though they were living in France, this experience crossed the miles. I guess very, very briefly, because I go into this in a bit of detail in the book, because it's important, is... How did the Khmer Rouge come to power? And it is absolutely the case that in 1965, you would not have wagered $1 on the Khmer Rouge ever making anything of their bid for power in Cambodia. And yet, by 1970, things had changed sufficiently that their route to power was very nearly assured. And in fact, 40 years ago this month, they took Phnom Penh, and with that, they took the country. So it's very briefly, it's worth pointing out that Cambodia's descent into those terrible days was driven in large part by what was happening in the region. What was happening in neighboring Vietnam was critical. As Vietnam slid into the civil war, the effects of that spilled over comprehensively into Cambodia and started to undermine what Cambodia was. There were domestic issues too, and again, I mentioned those in the book. I won't go into them now. But the point being is that Cambodia was between 1965 and 1970 as much the fate of its giant neighbor, relatively anyway, giant neighbor, as it was of anything going wrong within the country itself. In 1970, of course, Sihanouk, the leader of Cambodia, was overthrown in a coup, a bloodless coup. He was out of the country. Until that point, he'd been fighting the Khmer Rouge and considered them his sworn enemies. And he dealt pretty violently with anyone who was suspected of belonging to the movement. Once he was overthrown, his enemy's enemy became his friend, or so he thought. He went to Beijing. He was persuaded to join forces with the Khmer Rouge. And with that, he called on the Cambodian people to rise up with him, join him, and fight the Khmer Rouge. And thousands of Cambodians, and probably tens of thousands of Cambodians did. And overnight, the Khmer Rouge received a significant boost to their forces. And really, that was the start of the civil war proper. Other elements came in as well. The Khmer Rouge started getting support from Vietnam, from Hanoi, from Beijing, which they had previously been denied for reasons I go into in the book and I won't go into now. But all these things combined to ensure that by 1970-71, Cambodia's descent into a Khmer Rouge takeover was all but assured. And indeed, that is what ended up happening. The consequences, I spoke earlier about how people don't necessarily, and I didn't either myself when I left in 2003, understand the why did this happen. And a lot of Cambodians don't understand it either. It's an unfathomable thing. The consequences, though, are much better understood and are with Cambodia still today, although it's come quite a long way, of course. And the consequences were the destruction of what economists call human capital, so talented people who were killed, who died in terrible circumstances, who were executed, who may have survived and then in 1979 went to the refugee camps and left Cambodia for France, for the USA, for Australia, and have never returned. And the result for Cambodia has been a significant loss of this human capital. There were other significant losses too. Infrastructure was virtually destroyed. during the Civil War. The Khmeris didn't build anything of value. So by the time the Khmeris were driven out of power in 1979, there wasn't a lot left. A traumatized population and not much else. So, but as I say, the consequences are quite well understood because they're still with Cambodia today, whereas the reasons behind the rise of the Khmer Rouge, of course, are history, and I guess for that reason aren't quite as well understood. And that brings me on to the next thing, which is how do countries deal with these post-atrocity situations? And I mentioned earlier that my country, South Africa, had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That's one option countries can go down. There are other options too. There are judicial processes, which Cambodia's had, and different countries choose different processes, or they choose none at all, in the case of Mozambique, which determined that there was no profit to be had, no moral gain to be had from having an interrogation into what had happened during that country's two-decade-long civil war, when 2 million people died. And that decision was broadly welcomed, it seems, by most Mozambicans. I guess the two key resolutions in terms of processes are a judicial process like Cambodia's had and a truth and reconciliation process, and they're vastly different. A truth and reconciliation process is not concerned really at all with punishment and justice, certainly in South Africa's case. People who stood up in front of the commission and told what they had done for political ends, what crimes they'd committed, for political ends, were effectively guaranteed an amnesty. Very controversial, but all these processes are, inevitably, they're political solutions to what are effectively political crimes, and there are always going to be controversies, shortcomings, failures that go with them. In Cambodia's case, Cambodia established the tribunal, and that's very circumscribed too. It's circumscribed in terms of its time period, which is 1975 to early 79. It's circumscribed by who could be tried, those most responsible and the senior surviving leaders. And it's circumscribed by politics. But these things, I'm one of those who's not surprised at the political interference that's gone on, because these are political mechanisms. So that hasn't surprised me perhaps as much as it has some other journalists and reporters about it. So in Cambodia in 2003, the deal was signed. In 2006, I believe it was, the tribunal opened its doors. And in 2009, Doik's trial began. And that brings me back to Martine and Neri, because one of the things that the tribunal, I think, should be and has been credited for and certainly should be is the involvement of civil parties. And in the tribunal context, civil parties like Martine, like Neri, like the 91 other people who signed on as civil parties in case one, which is the trial of Doik, they were recognized by the court as people who had suffered under the crimes that were on the docket. So they were recognized as people who, in Doik's case, their loved ones had been through S21, or they had been through S21 themselves and survived, which is a very small number, of course. So the benefit of being a civil party in a process like that is, instead of having the objectivities of prosecutors and defense lawyers and that sort of thing, and procedural days and all the rest, you have days where people who have suffered tremendously get to tell the bench what their experience was. And it injects, I think, much-needed humanity into the procedure. And I think some of the very best days, in terms of most interesting, in terms of most gripping days at the tribunal, were people, whether Cambodian, whether foreign, who spoke about what had happened to their loved ones and how that had affected them. And I think that was an important step forward, because this was the first international tribunal that tried that. Although there were some controversies with it and some debates about the involvement of civil parties, I think it was a broadly positive thing. It put some humanity into the process, which otherwise could have been lost, I think, along the way. It wasn't the first time, 2009, it was not the first time that Neri and Martine had come to Cambodia. They first came here in 1991. Prior to that, even though the Khmer had been driven from power in 79, Cambodia and the Cold War was still going on, and Cambodia remained effectively a closed country to most people. But as the Cold War ended, the country started opening up. And that allowed Neri and Martine and Neri's brother, Makara, to come to Cambodia for the first time and to meet Ket's family. Now, by now, they knew what had happened to Ket. They knew he had landed in Cambodia in 1977 after being recalled by the foreign ministry to get better educated to fulfill your responsibilities, whatever that meant. But Ket was reasonably confident, very confident, that it wouldn't be that bad. And he was disbelieving, as a lot of returnees were, of these stories emanating from the Cambodian refugee population that had managed to slip across the border. Stories of people being worked to death, stories of this mysterious Angkar, stories of mass executions. They weren't widely believed. Ket didn't believe them, not least because Khmer do not kill Khmer. And so Ket came back in full confidence that he could help rebuild his country, which was a noble enough pursuit. And of course, a lot of other Cambodians from overseas came back for the same reasons. By one count, by Ong Tong Hoeng's count, who lives in Belgium, he was a returnee. He came back in 76. He counted 1,900 people he knew or knew of that had come back, and only 200 had survived. So a lot of people were recalled to be killed, and Ket, as it turns out, was one of them. Of course, had he known that, he would never have come back, but he didn't know that. So they knew by the time they came here in 91 what had happened to Ket, but they never met his family, what was left of it. They had never obviously been to Phnom Penh or to Cambodia, and they wanted to see S21, and they wanted to see Chung Ek, the killing field. And they went there, and they were appalled by what they saw, understandably. So the point being, I suppose, that they were not novices to Cambodia when they arrived here in 2009 to see the start of Doig's trial. And they came back and forth several times that year in order to testify. On one occasion, to see the start of Doig's trial, of course, to testify mid-year, and to see the end of his trial in November. And then they came back for the verdict the following year in 2010. Briefly on their testimonies, it's worth putting, and the book goes into, devotes a chapter to each of their testimonies, because Doig's trial comes in probably two-thirds through the book, and it takes up, I guess, about, I don't know, maybe a quarter of the book. But it was a fascinating trial. I won't go into the details here, but anyone who, and there's a number of my journalist colleagues here, like Luke, for example, and various others, were part and parcel of witnessing that and reporting on that. Anyone who reported on that will know full well how interesting it was as a tribunal, as a court case. They came back. Their testimonies are quite different. So Martin's testimony to the court, which you can read about in the book, is largely devoted to her as a young mother and a young wife, whose husband disappears when she's 24, and she spends several years trying to find out what has happened to him. Where is he? He'd left. They sent him off at the airport in Paris. He sent a postcard from Karachi in Pakistan, which was the first stop for the plane. The next stop was Beijing, which was the only route in and out of Cambodia. They got another postcard from him there. I'll be in Cambodia in a few days, and they never heard from him again. And so the weeks went by, and the months went by, and then the years went by, and she tried desperately to find out what had happened to her husband. Eventually, late 79, after the Khmer had been overthrown, a lot of refugees were pouring across the border into refugee camps in Thailand, camps like Khao Dang, Site 2, various other places. She went to Khao Dang camp, and she met a friend of the family's who, by coincidence, had spent part of 1979 working for the Vietnamese at S21, cataloguing the massive archive Doig had left behind, and the archive that would prove Doig's fundamental undoing, given that his signature was on so many execution warrants, etc., etc. And this friend spoke to Martine, and he said to her, "I saw Ket's name in the archives, and he was executed." And so she had to go back to France and tell her two small children that their father wasn't coming home. So that was a powerful part of her testimony, and really brought home what I suppose a lot of people had to deal with in terms of recalibrating their lives without their loved one. She went from being a young mother to being a widow to be having to provide for her family. And that was and as she said, Ket's murder was inexcusable, and it destroyed their family, which in a very real way it did. Neri's testimony was quite different. Her father was just two when he left. She has very fleeting memories of him. And as the years went by, she grew up understanding more and more each year what it meant to have gone to a place like S21. And so her testimony was quite different to Martine's. Was fascinating as well, I have to say, in its own way. And it was a story of a young girl growing up without her father, which was her normality, and then trying through her life to try and get some sort of as she understood more and more of what had happened, to get some sort of resolution and some sort of justice for Ket. And her testimony to the tribunal was her effort to achieve that. Two final points, both linked to that sort of few days in August 2009 when they testified. The one, I went out for dinner with Martin and Neri the night before they testified, and we had dinner. They were both understandably quite stressed, wound up about what was coming the following day. And Martin said to Neri, you know, when Doik stands up to address me after I've had my say, my testimony, which Doik did after every civil party he was entitled to address them, I'm going to take my headphones off because I don't want to hear a word he has to say, and I refuse to listen to him. And Neri said, ah, Mama, come on, you know, how much harm can it do? Just, you know, don't make a scene. And sure enough, Martine, she finished her testimony, powerful testimony, and Doik stands to speak to her, and he stands and his hands are on the table, and Doik's over there, she's in the witness chair, she looks up and away to the left, and as he starts speaking, she removes her headphones, and it visibly unnerved Doik. He stops, he stammers, he doesn't quite know what to do. This is the first time in that court for a man who has been listened to intently by everyone, including the judges, this is the first time someone's refused to hear what he had to say, and he didn't quite know what to do with it. And it was Martin's way of saying, I don't care what you have to say, I don't believe a word of it, and I'm not going to listen to it. And it was her standing up for Ket and for herself and her family. And that was quite a profound moment, I think. The last point I'd make is this, is that that evening, Neri called me, and she said to me, I want to go back to S21, to Tulsleng Genocide Museum, as it's called now, tomorrow, because I want to say goodbye to Dad. And Mum doesn't want to come, so I wondered if you'd like to. And I thought, yeah, I'd be honored. Let's do that. So the following morning, we met up, and we went down to S21. And we went to, by now, they knew exactly what cell Ket had been held in. So anyone who's been to S21 will know that on the ground floor of Building C, which is where he was held, there are these rough brick walls, divisions going through what were classrooms. And in cell number 23 is where Ket was held for some months. He was there for almost 6 months. So we went into cell 23, and Neri pulls a black marker out of her bag, and she starts writing with it on the wall of the cell. And I was somewhat conflicted by this because she had previously asked the museum, would they allow her to put a plaque up to her father in the cell, and they said no. And she was determined to leave a message for him. I was conflicted by it. I totally understood what she was trying to do. I didn't feel comfortable standing near someone who it might appear to a casual observer was graffitiing in a place like this. So I made my excuses and left her to it. And, you know, this was her final moment with her dad, and I felt that my concerns ought not to be her concerns. So I left her. By the time I left, she'd written maybe three or four letters, W-E-A-R, and then I headed out. And I waited for her in the courtyard. She came out quite a few minutes later. She'd had some time there. And we went back into the cell, and the message she'd written on the cell was, we are leaving. And it was in English. And I said to Neri, well, firstly, why have you written to Ket in English? Because he spoke French and Khmer. And secondly, what do you mean by the message? And she said, I've written it in English because in French you can't have this dual meaning. And the meaning for her dad was, we're leaving, and Mum and I are leaving, and you need to come with us too. And she said, and the other meaning is, it's a message to the Khmer Rouge, is that you killed him, but you didn't kill all of us, and now we're leaving. Thank you. There's no second microphone. So, there are 2 second microphones. Fantastic. So if anyone wants to ask any questions, Luke is going to deal with that side of things. I'm going to have a sip of beer.
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Sure.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
In researching and writing the book, did you run into many ex-KRKder who were proud of what they had done, or do any live? Are there any left?
There's many left. So I think Doik is still quite proud of what he achieved at S21. And one of the things about S21 is it is almost certainly the best-run institution in Democratic Kampuchea. He was a formidable organizer, and the job he was tasked with doing, he was extremely good at doing it. You know, the moral dimension clearly didn't occur to him. He wasn't interested in it. He was a believer in the revolution, in the purity of the revolution, and in the fact that the individual under Democratic Kampuchea had no worth whatsoever. So to stand in the way of revolution, of the revolution, as everyone who was brought into S21 was deemed to have done, was to be, the phrase he used at trial, dead already. And one of the chapters in the book is called Dead Already. I went, in 2010, I went up to An Long Veng with a group, an NGO group, and this gentleman next to you. We went up there, and there was a reconciliation day happening at Tom Ok's compound. Tom Ok being one of the, for those who don't know, one of the least pleasant of the Khmer Rouge leaders, and that's saying something. He was dead by then. He died in 2006 in prison. And the reconciliation day was an attempt to get former Khmer Rouge together and ask what they wanted out of the process of the tribunal, which was a fairly generous thing to be doing, I have to say, and certainly is, I think, not something a lot of Cambodians would go along with. A lot of Cambodians don't revile the Khmer Rouge still, or the former Khmer Rouge, and the former Khmer Rouge hate being called former Khmer Rouge. They only call Cambodians these days. But studies have shown, and there's been some very good studies by, I think UC Berkeley did one, that most Cambodians do not want to have a drink with anyone who is ex-Khmer Rouge, don't want their children to go to school with children of ex-Khmer Rouge. They want nothing to do with them at all. The other thing about that day at An Long Veng, though, is that a lot of these guys signed up because Sihanouk asked people to join the movement. And a lot of the others who signed up before that did so because they wanted a better Cambodia. And the trajectory of Cambodia it was determined by its leaders, not by its followers. So I don't know. I haven't met any former Khmer Rouge who I think I'd describe as proud of what they did. I mean, one of the gentlemen at the event in An Long Veng stood up and said, you know, what do we do all this for? We've got nothing out of it. The country was destroyed. What was the point of this? Why are we so stupid as to follow our leaders? You know, he'd lost a lot too. I mean, he lost a leg for a start, but I mean, he obviously lost family. They'd been living in terrible conditions for years on the border in malaria-infested jungles. No, I think there's a lot of damaged people on all sides. And it's important to remember there's a lot of gray area in all of this stuff. It doesn't profit anyone to think, oh, Khmer Rouge bad. It just isn't that simple. So I'm sure there are some former Khmer Rouge who are proud of what they achieved. I think Nguyen Chia is quite proud of what they achieved. All the killings he blames on Vietnam. And we've seen that at trial. He doesn't think he did anything wrong. But nor did Pol Pot. You know, Pol Pot, when Nate Thayer interviewed him in 98, I think it was, he said, you know, look at me. Even now, my conscience is clear. I'm not a wicked person. So when you have someone who had that much responsibility going, nothing to do with me, I think some of the senior leadership probably were quite proud. I think Doik was quite proud of what he achieved.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, Rob, was we've all seen the amount of information that's come out of the tribunal has been tremendous. And in terms of the politics and everything around that, we're all, I think, very well versed in it. But what's your take on the personalities of those that have been charged? I mean, we haven't really got into the personality of, say, someone like May Mood or Lung Che, who have just been charged. Mm-hmm. But in terms of getting to know and love them, Khieu Samphan, Nguyen Chia, and S21, what's your take on their personalities? Well, the differences between them?
Yeah, I mean, so Khieu Samphan and Nguyen Chia, Khieu Samphan, who was head of state, has long held that he had no real power in Democratic Kampuchea and really shouldn't be on trial at all. Nguyen Chia said the Vietnamese did it all. My take on them is, I mean, I've watched some of Case 2, but actually quite a lot of Case 2 I spent writing my book. So I didn't go to attend Case 2 nearly as much as I did Case 1 with Doik. My take on Doik is that he's a guy who tried running two separate defenses at his trial for a start. So that gives you an idea of his character. He claimed that he was terribly sorry for everything that had happened. He also claimed, he also said at trial that he would not appeal his sentence. You know, let the Cambodian people stone me like St. Stephen, because of course he converted to Christianity in the vague hope that would, I guess, wash away his sins if there's some sort of afterlife. And yet he did appeal his sentence. He pledged his door would always be open to the families of the victims. Door was not open to the family of the victims. I mean, I tried to interview him on behalf of Neri and Martin for the book, and he turned me down twice. He's a thoroughly amoral person. I mean, Nunchia, I mean, these are very slippery guys. They didn't stay in their positions of power by being good people, honest men. So I guess the short answer is, K Steel I haven't followed nearly as much, but Doik is a fairly reprehensible human being who was given a chance, actually, to get back his humanity at trial by not trying to dodge his responsibilities, and he proved unable to do that. And that surprised a lot of people. I had hoped at Doik's trial that we would see a guy who recognized the extraordinary amount of damage he'd done and would be genuinely repentant about it. And Ritty Pan, whose face has flashed up here a couple of times this evening, who I interviewed for the book as well, he spent hundreds of hours interviewing Doik in 2008. And Ritty said to me, well, this is in the book as well, he said, you know, if Doik admits to everything, I would even be in favor of releasing him. If he just shows he's back to humanity, then you know, why not have him back in the fold? But he said he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. So
I'll throw one more name in there. Yang Tariq. The female side of the equation isn't looked at often enough, I don't think, but interesting nevertheless.
Yeah, again, I mean, so Yang Tarit was the wife of Yang Siri, the foreign minister. She was social affairs minister, and her sister was married to Pol Pot, so she was very well connected. She studied in Paris. She studied, I think she was the first Cambodian English major. She majored in Shakespeare or something. Very smart woman. She was part of case two. She was found to be mentally incapable of standing trial, which I think was probably a fair finding. She's believed to have Parkinson's or dementia of some sort. Dementia of some sort. I can't say I know much about her beyond what we saw at trial, which was somebody who appeared to be not in full control, which I think is probably actually legitimately how she was. I think she was perhaps losing her ability to function. You know, she was on trial because she was one of the senior people in the Khmer Rouge regime, and because a lot of people in her ministry got purged, which meant got killed. So she was on trial for that. I don't know that we'll ever know what really makes any of them tick, whether it be Yang Siri, who's dead now, Yang Tarit, Nunchia, Khi Somphan. All we've seen in case two, and to a degree in case one as well, is people trying to dodge their responsibility in one way or another. And that's, but I think that's an indictment of the kind of outfit the Khmer Rouge were. Trust no one, be paranoid, and kill everyone who you think might be standing in your way.
Hello, Rob. Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
As I understand, quite a number of returnees went through Bondrabhai prison before, you know, S21. I was just wondering, did Ket go through Bondrabhai then to S21? And if not, why not? And in your research, did you find anything out about the administration of Bondrabhai that we don't know?
So I didn't research Bondrabhai, in fact, because Ket didn't go there. What we think happened to Ket, he was, within less than a week, he was in S21. So he returned on, I think, the 15th of June, 77, and I think his entry date in the register is the 21st of June. So within less than a week, he was in S21. Martin and Neri think it's likely he was held at the foreign ministry, which was run by Yang Siri, for some days, and then it is likely he would have been told, brother, you know, come with us, we need to take you to a new place for work, and he would have gone along through the empty streets of Phnom Penh, like so many others did, and would have been taken up to one of the nearby streets, Street 360. There was a guard post there, and he would have been arrested there. So whether he was arrested on his own or with others is not clear. It's I would say certainly didn't go to Bung Trabek because he was inside S21 within days. So we think he probably stayed at the ministry for a few days and was then arrested effectively. But Bung Trabek I didn't look into. No, I know Sam Ranzi has, in terms of the current foreign minister Hor Nam Hong's involvement there. But I didn't look into any of that, no.
Hi. Just one more question.
Sure.
When the tribunal announced that they would continue trialing, I don't remember the names of the two last people, the prime minister went out and said that basically everybody would have to run to the jungle because nobody would be able to control the army anymore and there would be a civil war and so forth. What I wonder is, what was the rhetoric like from the same leadership back in the 70s when all these trials began and people were actually starting to look for responsible people?
Well, there was only one trial, in inverted commas, is not regarded very highly. In mid-79, the Pol Pot Yeng Sirui clique were put on trial here in, I think, the Chakdimuk Theatre in Phnom Penh. And even the defence lawyer, because they were tried in absentia, right? Even the defence lawyer suggested they should be hanged. So it's not regarded as a particularly honest judicial process. Hun Sen's comments on the this could spark civil war, I mean, to me, are outlandish. I mean, the former Khmer Rouge who are in a condition to fight, I would say, are few and far between. And I just don't believe there's any incentive to do anything like that. These guys are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. They have their plots of land. Their kids are going to school, which incidentally was an institution the Khmer Rouge banned, along with everything else. And they have a stake in society now. They don't have as much of a stake as they'd like, but they still have a stake in society. So going to what Hun Sen said about civil war, etc., etc., I mean, to my mind, is nonsense. That would indicate that he has less control over this country than I think everyone knows he has. The real story behind it is the longer this goes on, the more the risk of unpalatable truths emerging about other senior people in the ruling party, not him, I don't think, but others in the ruling party who are very senior, and what they got up to during that time, because a lot of the current leadership were defectors in 77, 78 from the Khmer Rouge who fled across to Vietnam to escape the purges. And they do not want information coming that might come out of future trials of their involvement in mass killings, etc., etc. And it's fairly well known who some of these guys are. And Hun Sen, like any politician, is reliant on other politicians for staying in power. So the longer this goes on, I think, essentially, the worse for him in terms of, or his colleagues anyway, in terms of the risk. So I think it's just overblown rhetoric is the short answer.
Congratulations on the book, Rob.
Thank you, Lauren.
Regarding the participation of your subjects, Martin and Neri, after the case was over, do they feel like they got any closure from participating in civil parties? And what does it mean to them now in the years since?
It's a good question because, of course, participating can be a bit of a two-edged sword. It dredges up the old memories and the old pains that you spend decades trying to put to bed. I think broadly they were A, satisfied with the process, and secondly were satisfied with the verdicts. I mean, there were two verdicts, right? Doik, for those who don't know, was initially jailed for effectively 35 years, and then he appealed that, and he was then jailed for life. On appeal, which was itself controversial. Yes, they were happy to see him go to jail for life. They were also happy to see him go to jail first time round, because at his age, which was late 60s, it was effectively a life sentence anyway. Getting their chance to speak in court, I think if you ask them both today, they would both say yes, that was a beneficial thing. It allowed them to share the pain that they'd suffered with a wider audience. And I think that for them was probably quite useful. They found some aspects of the tribunal incredibly frustrating. Applying as a civil party was difficult, and there were certainly occasions when the judges seemed actually not that interested in what the civil parties had to say in the first place, which was a frustration for civil parties. And you know, they had other issues with it too. But broadly, they were satisfied with the process. All that said, I mean, it's an impossible situation because it's a tribunal. It can't wind back the clock. There are no good answers to come out of a tribunal. There are only small satisfactions, really. But within that, I think they were broadly satisfied, yeah.
So, given what you know about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, experience through that, what would you, and given the trial here in Cambodia, what would you think would have been a more appropriate is the trial the right way, or would Cambodia have benefited more in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for what they want?
You know, it's not even an either-or. You can do both. Rwanda's done both. I think both is good. In fact, both are good grammatically. But these are political decisions. So there wasn't a lot of work done on what the Cambodian people would like to have happen. Among the small amounts of work that was done, what they didn't want was a purely Cambodian judicial process, because Cambodians rightly do not trust their judicial system. There was a recognition that would not, if there was a judicial process, it would need international involvement. So that's the first thing. In terms of a TRC, a Truth and Reconciliation process, I recall reading, and this is searching my brain here, that it was felt as perhaps too confrontational for the period that those questions were asked, which has to be said was the late 90s, early 2000s, so the Civil War had only really just ended. And so I guess perhaps if people ask the same question today, they might get a different answer. But I see no reason why a country can't have both. You couldn't have it. As I say, Rwanda's done both to, you know, greater or lesser success.
Hi, Ron.
Hi, Ollie.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Bouncing back on what was just said, I was wondering if you could, you touched upon in your introduction, the importance of memory and whether through Truth and Reconciliation or a trial or other efforts such as your book, and where it fits into this idea of memorializing and naming the dead, civil parties participating, acknowledging their suffering individually, and well, it's just the picture of Ket. In the case of your book, you know, naming one victim. And the importance of that process of memory and healing.
Yeah, it's very important, and it's important in a reconciliation context, I think, than a judicial context. I spoke. This is one of the things I spoke to Riti Pan about, the director, when I interviewed him, because as I say, he spent so much time interviewing Doik. I wanted to speak to Riti and get, as Doik refused to interview with me, I thought, well, the next best thing is find someone who's spoken at length to Doik, and that was something Riti mentioned, and he said, you know, Riti is basically a supporter of the tribunal on the grounds that this is really the first time that all these people have been recognized in some context. And he said that's really important. And this kind of goes to a question that I've been asked before, which is, well, do people think that $240 million is a lot of money for a tribunal? And I think that's missing the point. I mean, the money is not the issue here. There are bigger issues at stake than money. Memorialization is very important. And it can be controversial. You know, last week we had a memorial opening at S21, Tuol Sleng Genocide Museum, as it's called now, and it will list every person who went through S21, of whom the majority by far were Khmer Rouge cadre. So you have this mixture. Uket should be said was not, and 20% of the other people were not either. But you have this sort of amalgamation of people who may have been perpetrators being named on the same slabs of black marble as others who were absolutely, some of them absolutely were perpetrators, no question of that. And I'm sure a bunch of Khmer Rouge were not either. I mean, if you worked in ministries in Phnom Penh, which were purged regularly, you may not have done anything wrong, case being the wrong place at the wrong time. So the memorialization thing, I think, is important. It's part of what the very few NGOs doing reconciliation work in Cambodia, for them, memorialization is an important part of what they do. And Kadai Karana being, I guess, the one I know the most about. It's very important. But there's a whole broader question of reconciliation, which I touch on again in the book, because the book's already long enough, and I there's only so much you can go into. But the reconciliation side of things in Cambodia has been largely ignored by the government. And there's just a small amount of work happening. I happen to think it's about the most important thing that can be done. And certainly the section on Kadai Karana in the book, which is towards the end of the book, I think shows why that's so important. Bringing people together again after all this time. Yeah.
Congratulations again, Rob.
Thanks.
I was wondering, is the book expected to be translated into Khmer, number one, and what do you expect the reaction from Cambodians will be, and what do you hope maybe the reaction will be?
So will it be translated into Khmer? I'd like it to be. And I know that about a year ago, before it was available, the Center for Khmer Studies were considering it for that, and it'd be great if they did that. I'd be completely happy with it being translated into Khmer. It'd be even longer, of course, in Khmer, because you need more space for words. In translating it, though, one of the things about translating, of course, is it's in English, and some of what's in English was originally in Khmer, so all was in French. So there's this whole issue of translation at the tribunal, which was for journalists and people taking part in it, was an issue in itself. You have that whole problem of things coming in there where actually people need to go back to the source documents to see what Doig actually said in Khmer versus what my transliteration of that is into English. Would I like to be translated into Khmer? Absolutely, I would. If Cambodians read it, I'd like to think that they'd find it would answer some questions and might be of use. But that'd be my hope. But my other hope on it is that people coming to Cambodia will read it and be better informed about what went on here. And that really was, as I said at the beginning, that was the reason I wanted to. When I met Martina Neri, it occurred to me that their story of loss and disappearance would provide a useful bridge between the experience of ordinary Cambodians, so many of them, a bridge for an outside audience that isn't familiar with Cambodia at all.
Thank you. We spoke about justice and reconciliation, but I know you've been writing on health issues also. So I was wondering in your research and your analysis with this family, whether you have any suggestions on investment in mental health, because Rwanda, for example, invested a lot in psychological services for its population, and here the budget and investment in mental health is extremely, extremely small and recent. So any suggestions you have on that, because millions of people have been left to themselves to cope with this history and in their daily lives still live with it now.
Yeah, it's a really important part of Cambodia. I mean, this kind of goes to the heart of my opinion of the Cambodian government, which is they don't care too much about their own people. The entire budget for mental health, perhaps 4 or 5 years ago, I think was around $30,000. That was the national budget. I mean, it's ludicrous. It's indicative of a government that doesn't care about that as an issue. Given how many Range Rovers there are on the streets, it's outrageous. There is some more money going into mental health now, but far too little. And there's organizations like TPO Cambodia that do a fantastic job. And there are doctors working in, I think the Cambodia Daily and the Phnom Penh Post have done stories on this in recent years, of the doctors working there, and they have maybe 10 minutes a patient. And they give them 3 red pills and come back in a month, because they are so overworked and there are so few psychiatrists and psychologists who can help. So the people who are doing work are doing excellent work. There's not nearly enough money involved in it. And perhaps if the government took corruption seriously, they could actually fund a better health service, and that would include not just health but mental health too. I think it's a hugely neglected area in Cambodia today, especially given what happened, and especially given the rates of PTSD among Cambodian survivors, which are very high.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Doug.
So I have a question about whether or not anyone has ever released from S21. So, as you recall, I think just before opening arguments, Yook threw a bomb because he had claimed to have proven that I think just under 200 people were in fact released, and he had records to show that Doig had in fact considered whether or not to release people. And the defense got very angry. I think this sort of countered the theory of their defense, which was that Doig had no choice.
Yeah.
He had no choice but to kill everybody. And in fact, here were records showing that he could, say, recommend someone's release, and he had in fact done so in an infinitesimal small percentage of all the cases. So did you look into that, since you have a chapter, as you said, I think it's called Already Dead, or Dead Already?
Dead Already.
Yeah. So, I mean, you seem to be subscribing to the theory, which the prosecution, I think, abandoned, which was that S21 could not, did not, and would not release anyone.
Yeah, so, I mean, Yook's argument actually makes it into a footnote into the book. Yes, I think that the figure DC CAM came up with, the research organization, and Yook Chang, who runs it, a few years back, they came up with a figure. Well, for the longest time, the perceived wisdom of S21 was, if you went there, you were dead already, and very few people survived it. Among them was Van Nat, of course, the artist, another Bumeng, and another guy, Chum Mei, who are S21 most days of the week. But out of perhaps 20,000 people that went through there, 12 surviving is a minuscule, infinitesimal amount. Yes, DC CAM went through the records and reckoned that I think 169 other people had been released. Doik rejected that at trial, and I suspect rejected it because it would have implied he had some latitude and chose not to exercise it in most cases, particularly when it came to, say, children, of whom there were hundreds killed. So it does make it in as a footnote. I think the bigger issue on all of that is that the number of people who survive S21, whether it's 12, 15, 20, or maybe as many as 200, the overall situation for most people who went in there was that they were dead already, and they were perceived, as Ritty mentions in his excellent book, The Elimination, they were like pieces of wood, the gods told them. They were like animals. We weren't worried about our karma because they were subhuman. So they did whatever they wanted them. And I think for most people, the chances of coming out alive were negligible. I mean, in a room like this, statistically, no one would come out alive. I mean, even if it's 200 people out of 20,000, that's what, 0.1%. I mean, it's a tiny amount. So I think the bigger picture was true, that people who went there were dead already. Did Doik have latitude? He said he didn't. I mean, who can know, though, right? Who can know? He's not the man who... he's not a particularly truthful man. And he had reason to lie, so, about that, you know.
Hey, Rob. Congratulations.
Thanks, Rick.
So presumably Nyeri is maybe more French than Cambodian culturally.
Yeah.
Did you get to see any interactions between Martine and Nyeri that were notable with Cambodian Khmers, especially on Khmer Rouge, or, say, for instance, the verdict?
They, you know, the day of Doik's verdict, there was a lot of controversy because Doik's effective sentence, he'd spent so much time in jail, his effective sentence was 19 years, and there was some controversy about that with people, survivors and you know, and civil parties outside the court saying this is outrageous that the guy gets effectively 19 years for what he did. They didn't subscribe to that. They were satisfied that was a suitable judgment. And they were more satisfied with the life sentence, of course, because that's what they felt he deserved. But if that was what it was going to be, then that was satisfactory for them. You know, among the things, again, this is in the book I mentioned, is that Nyeri, one of the things Nyeri was worried about, and has always been worried about psychologically, is that her dad was Khmer, and what happened in Cambodia was Khmer killing Khmer, and she long worried and whether this was some inherent sort of defect within her that would come out and haunt her in later life, that there was this half of her being was somehow capable of great cruelty and all the rest of it, and she never heard anyone else speak about that. She spoke about it. She never heard anyone else speak about that. So in terms of her addressing issues that I suppose other people might not have, that would probably be it, but. Going back to who they are, I mean, they're French. I mean, they grew up in, you know, both grew up in France. Nyeri was born in Senegal, but she grew up in France most of her life from the age of two. She visited Cambodia several times, mainly during Doik's trial. But she has no great desire to come back to Cambodia. She'd come back to see Angkor Wat, interestingly, but that'll be it. She hasn't seen it yet. But beyond that, no, none whatsoever. And she certainly wouldn't come and live here.
Yes, thank you for your a very interesting talk.
Sure. Henri, sorry.
I did not attend the tribunal the day Phuket and his wife and child testified, unfortunately, in the middle of the summer when I'm in France. But I think you picked up a very strong personality and a very strong case. For the returnees, I think that they were very unfortunate because very few, as far as we know, went straight from the airport practically to S21. I'm a bit surprised that you mentioned 6 months. You showed the date that he was in that cell for 6 months.
Not necessarily in that cell, but in S21, absolutely, yeah. Not necessarily in cell 23, though. We don't know he was there for 6 months. We know he was in that cell. We don't know he was in that cell for 6 months. It's likely he was in a shackled in a larger room prior to that, as most...
Already, you know, the average was about 3 months.
Yeah.
Which is, this has not been sufficiently mentioned in the tribunal. But this is where, you know, the Dutch, as the formidable organizer, you said, made S21 a very special institution in comparison to the other 150 other provincial prisons. Mm-hmm. Because in the provincial prisons, the average duration of the stay was about 3 weeks, and not 3 months, and let alone 6 months. So you can imagine the torture, the suffering, the gradual starvation, over that period. This being said, I would not be quite as pessimistic as you are about Dutch. As you said, well, he's an extraordinary organizer. He conceived this whole institution, this total institution, as David Chandler says.
Yeah.
But I'm not so sure that now he's proud of what he's done, as you said. And I think that I attended many of the hearings. Mm-hmm. And of course, he read pre-prepared apologies. That's agreed. But quite a number of times, his apologies were spontaneous, mm-hmm. and they seemed genuine. Mm-hmm. And at one time he said, what I did with young adolescents, training them to become torturers and executioners, was infinitely worse than the soldiers who executed at Chiang Kai. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a very strong declaration. Now, he doesn't want to see anybody, including myself, including Father François Porchot, who tried last week, because he's so, I think, offended that his remarkable cooperation with the tribunal over 9 months. Mm-hmm. And you see the contrast with the two old men sitting there. And last week, there was a very moving civil party who testified, was 8 under the Cameroon. Mm-hmm. And suffered and was punished intensely just because she wanted to run away to see her parents. Mm-hmm. And she asked a question to Nunchi and Ki Sampo. Mm-hmm. Why did you make children suffer so much? Mm-hmm. And you know what the two old men answered? Silence. Mm-hmm. Silence.
Yeah.
I mean, in contrast to Dutch, who always wanted to speak. So I think, and this is why the second trial is much less interesting, simply because there's no participation at all on the part. Nunchi wanted to speak at the beginning, but his lawyers shut his mouth because they followed the line of Jacques Vergès, the defense lawyer who's now died. And they are not defending their clients. They are making the trial of the trial.
So the defense lawyers in case two are basically doing what I guess defense lawyers in any such trial would do. They're dragging it out, hoping their clients, when the first case, would die and convicted. That hasn't happened. They've been convicted, but it's on appeal. And certainly that was the strategy for one of the other defendants in case two, who did die before he was convicted. That'd be Yang Siri. In terms of Doig, you know, he's a strange guy. I mean, there's no question of that. His psychological profile makes for interesting reading, and I go into that a little bit in the book. He is a man of operational contrasts. So depending on the situation he finds himself in, he has developed this effectively split personality, whereby, or what they call splitting. And I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, so this is what I understand it to be. But in a situation where he feels threatened, he will operate in a very different way to the situation in which he will normally be in. And I think we saw that at trial. I mean, at the end of his trial, he effectively just rejected the defense strategy of his lawyer, Francois Roux, and went for this ludicrous defense strategy of his other defense lawyer, Carsten Wood. And I don't know, I'm not convinced that Doig is particularly apologetic. He has made no effort to, I asked him twice to interview and he refused. Which, be as it is may, I sat through his trial thinking, I really hope this is a man who is genuinely sorry for what he did, because he should be. And at the end, I think his strategy at the end showed that he wasn't. I mean, we can only judge people by their actions. Their words are fabrications. And in someone like his case, where he's a man of such limited moral grandeur, his actions really do count, and his actions at the end of his trial were, I should be acquitted let me go home, which is astonishing. I mean, it's astonishing to come out at the end of a trial like that and think that that's good enough. It's not good enough. So I don't know. I don't subscribe to the view that he's not all that bad. I think he had, as Ritty Pan said, he had a chance to get back his humanity, and he dropped it. He chose not to. And I think that's how he should. I think it's how he should be remembered.
All the others deny any responsibility.
Sure, and he participated more than anyone else has. But I mean, we're not exactly. It's not a gold medal field. I mean, Nguyen Chir and Kyusum Pan are hardly you know, men whose performance has been exemplary. Doig, what he did contribute. He did participate. And at the end, he couldn't quite pull it off. And at the end, he failed. I mean, he failed himself, and I think he failed. He pledged throughout to the Cambodian people, you know, I will tell you the truth. I will take whatever punishments you throw me. And at the end, he just couldn't do it.
Hi, yeah. Rob.
Hey, Kevin.
Second question. At the beginning of your introduction, you mentioned Pat, you returned to Cambodia because you believed Khmers don't kill Khmers. I'm paraphrasing, I believe, what you said.
Yeah, that's what Martin said, yeah.
Okay, now you've spent about 3-4 years researching the regime, the Tutsi perpetrators. I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question. Did you come up with a theory of why there was so much brutality? Why was it as brutal as it was?
Yeah, it's what Ritty Pan called, this is Ukket, by the way. What Ritty Pan called the disease of purity, which I think is a good way of looking at it. So you had this disease of purity, this rigidity that you follow our form of political belief, and if you don't follow it, then you are the enemy. And you had quite an amazing array or confluence of things that came together here. One of which was a paranoid leadership that saw enemies everywhere. You know, Nguyen Chir, according to Doig, I do believe Doig on this one, by the way. Nguyen Chir said that. Doig said that Nguyen Chir came to him in probably 77. And he said to Doig, in the whole of Cambodia, only Brother Pol Pot and me are above suspicion. And I think Pol Pot would have disagreed. I think Pol Pot would have thought only he was above suspicion. And you had a leadership that saw enemies everywhere. The solution to enemies was to kill them because they could not be reformed. And that was a lesson Doig learned very early on in his running his first prison in 1971. And you had this incredibly rigid system in which brutality was encouraged. The country was divided between us and them, which is a classic pre-genocide, pre-mass killing situation. You have the us, the worthy, and the them, who are less worthy. And as soon as you separate people into those categories, discriminating against them in any way becomes much easier, and discriminating towards killing people, torturing, executing people who are perceived as dead already, it doesn't really matter. They're subhuman. So. I think there was a confluence of factors. It was driven by paranoia from the top, and it was driven by complete impunity, a totalitarian state, where you had, if you were accused of being an enemy, Angkor is all-seeing, and Angkor never makes mistakes. If Angkor says you're an enemy, you're an enemy, and if you're an enemy, we will kill you. That's it. And we won't kill you, we'll kill your family. If you're working in a ministry or in a bureaucratic level, we will kill everyone who works below you, and we'll get their families into you, and we will torture them, and we will find where these strings of traitors go. It's astonishing, in a way, it lasted as long as it did, and it's no surprise at all when Vietnam invaded that the army had collapsed, because the army had been purged so effectively from 1976 onwards, as had all the Khmer Rouge ranks, that they reached Phnom Penh in, what, 2 weeks? Not surprising at all. There was really, you know, no one left. It must have been terrifying in the final weeks, being a Khmer Rouge cadre, the final year even, when people were disappearing around you at a rapid rate. And for what? I mean, it's reasonable to assume that none of them were guilty of the crimes they were charged with by Angkor. I'm sure they were guilty of other things, but not necessarily the crimes they were charged with. So I think it's a long-winded answer, but I think it's a combination of things, yeah.
I think we'd like to take 2 or 3 more questions. Is that okay?
Sure. Sebastian looks like a likely candidate.
Although
I haven't planted all these questions from people I know. It's just coincidence.
Good to see Seth Meixner up the back with Kevin Doyle.
Yeah, I saw Seth sneak in. Welcome back, Seth.
Just to follow up on that last question.
Yeah.
What role, if any, do you think Cambodian culture played in the extent of the violence and the extent of the killing?
Good question. You know, I spoke to David Chandra about I interviewed extensively with David actually on this. And David Chandra, for those who don't know, is one of along with Henri Locard, by the way, who answered the question earlier, one of the preeminent historians of Cambodia. So Henri, thanks for coming. And I do mention you in the book, by the way, when you describe Doik as a very special person. I don't know if you remember, we spoke outside the tribunal. And you explained why he was so special, mainly because he lived such a long time and most of his contemporaries died long before him, were killed long before him. The Cambodian culture thing, it's a really dangerous question, isn't it? You know, in terms of the Khmer Rouge culture, the Khmer Rouge culture was that if you're an enemy, there is no chance of you reforming, and so we kill you. So in terms of Khmer Rouge culture, I think that's an easier question to answer. I don't think I know enough about Cambodian culture to answer whether there are specific things about Cambodian culture. You know, Alex Hinton tried to do that in his book, Why Did They Kill? And it's kind of controversial, some of the stuff he came out with. And I'm not an academic, Alex is. So I'm not sure how much of what he determined actually stands. And I think I guess being a white South African, you know, cultural constructs of people I find pretty dangerous in the first place. You know, we had a whole history of that in my country. So the short answer is I don't know. I think in terms of Khmer Rouge culture, yes, enemies everywhere, no chance of reforming. You're an enemy, we kill you. That's it. And that is absolutely what the cultural construct of the Khmer Rouge were. There's no chance for reform.
Questions. I've got a quick one. Do you think there should be some kind of term limit on the tribunal, or should it be allowed just to run indefinitely?
Well, there is a limit on it in terms of, in as much as cases 3 and 4, should they ever go to trial, are the final cases. So there is effectively a term limit. I mean, case 2, yes, we're on the second part of it now. There will be, I presume, more appeals if they're found guilty, and if they live long enough to be found guilty in the second part of their trial. I mean, a term limit in term to what end? I mean, if we're going to try and find out what happened here, which is and hand down judicial rulings on an equal-handed basis, then I don't see the wrapping it up early as of much benefit. I don't buy into the money argument where people say this is a lot of money. I don't think it is a lot of money. I mean, it is a lot of money, of course. It's more than I've got, $240 million, and more than most of us will ever see. But in terms of what it's trying to achieve and the crimes that it's dealing with and how important this was in 20th century history, I do not think $240 million is a lot of money. And if it went to $500 million, I still wouldn't think it's a lot of money, because these are relatively small sums on a global scale that are dealing with massive issues from the 20th century. So does that answer your question?
Kind of.
Hello.
Maybe a beer, Luke.
This is Anna from
Cambodia.
So thank you, everybody. So Sebastian mentioned about the question, what is the role of Cambodian culture into this kind of killing? Why don't we think about the global system, the global thought, the global education as well? Because in the 1950s, 60s, how many all of us here talk about human rights education? But right now we talk about human rights violation, so it's abuse the people to do the killing, and as you may know, even the Thai former prime minister, he got a high degree from UK, and he got so many people from the West, they still violate their citizens. So the whole point and my question is that how the global justice and the global education, global awareness of So, I mean, there is a united nation, if there's such a big effort to work on the human side right now, do you think that this kind of genocide happens?
I mean, I think one of the things you raised there early on is an important point, is that what happened in Cambodia is not unique. It is in some ways and it's not in others. I mean, humans have an amazing capacity to destroy and to kill and to inflict misery on each other. And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, British or South African or Cambodian or Russian or Brazilian. It makes little difference. It's hardwired into us. And we're almost all of us capable of doing that kind of thing, I think. The rest of the question, I mean, we could talk for hours on that. And I don't want to do that because because you know, the role of the United Nations in preventing genocide is established. It's meant to step in, but it's a community of nations, and if a community decides not to get involved, then, for example, like the Cambodian judicial process out here, the Khmer Tribunal, is a stem from the General Assembly, not the Security Council. The difference being, the Rwanda and the Yugoslav tribunals were motions were supported by the Security Council. This would not have been. And that's why there's plenty of money for the Rwanda tribunal and the Yugoslav tribunal, and it's not for this, because those two tribunals are compulsorily funded. This is voluntarily funded, because it's a General Assembly resolution. And so if you look at, I mean, the role of the United Nations in Cambodia has been pretty controversial. I mean, they allowed the Khmer Rouge, and it's a community of nations, right? So the community of nations allowed the Khmer Rouge to keep the Cambodian UN seat for about a decade after the Khmer Rouge was driven from power, which is astonishing. But that was, it's astonishing to us now. You can't imagine that would happen when the crimes of the Khmer Rouge were utterly apparent. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what the bigger point is, except to say that when it comes to individuals inflicting violence on individuals, we've seen it in every country in the world, and we will keep seeing it. When it comes to organizations like United Nations, I wouldn't put too much stock into what they can do. I think empowering people at a local level to take control of their own lives is a far more reliable way of ensuring that people don't get their human rights abused. And we've seen that happen in Cambodia, for example. You know, the Orang Valley Network in the Prelang, all these places, people coming together to work at a local level who have votes in this country and who can affect political outcomes. I think that's probably the most successful way for any country to try and ensure, you know, rights on abused of local people.
In conclusion, before yes. Even though Prime Minister Hossein is a bit sometimes even right, but he's still keep alive. Because we have a good international community to promote human rights. That's why he still keep opposition alive. So.
All right, Anna. Okay. Any other questions? Rob, how do you feel? You've been up there for about a good hour, I'd say.
I'm good. Yeah. Sorry, the lefe keeps flowing, so I'm fine.
No, big gun. One more or we'll go for
this is Anirudh, and he's going to sideline me with some Marxist political question like you tried to the other day.
No, I won't. So I want to know what you think it was the role of reformer King Norodom Sihanouk in granting moral legitimacy to the Khmer Rouge. And do you think without this grant of this recognition by Norodom Sihanouk,
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question. And Sihanouk, for those who don't know, died in 2012, I think it was, a couple of years ago. He was unquestionably the giant of Cambodian politics. And he made himself quite a significant figure internationally, too, in the non-aligned movement. When Sihanouk was overthrown in 1970, I mentioned it earlier, he threw in his lot with his former enemy, the Khmer Rouge, on the mistaken understanding he could control them. They recognized that he was a useful person to have, and he brought a lot of numbers. Sihanouk has had, and he recognizes himself, a huge responsibility in terms of what happened. It wasn't what he thought would happen. And his own children were killed by the Khmer Rouge, I think five of them. He suffered personally under it. He bears a significant responsibility for what happened. Had the former God King not said to people, join with me in this fight, a lot of people would not have joined in that fight. And who can say what would have happened? I think it's reasonably likely that the Khmer Rouge, if they had eventually taken control, it might not have happened for years and years afterwards. But the tens of thousands of people that flocked to Sihanouk's banner, as they thought they were doing, ended up bolstering the Khmer Rouge's ranks. And at that point, the other alignment that happened then was with Sihanouk out of the picture in Cambodian politics, Vietnam and China started backing the Khmer Rouge, which until that point they hadn't done, not in practical measures anyway. So it was sort of a double-edged thing there. It was of huge importance. Yeah, the Vietnam War and Sihanouk's effectively joining alliances with the Khmer Rouge were two critical factors.
I'm wondering what the family's reaction had been to the book and why it was important to them that their cat story was told to a wider audience beyond that, even as a kind of tribunal.
Yeah, so they were, I mean, between the two of them, Neri was I don't want to say more helpful, because that implies that Martine wasn't helpful. They're both supportive of it, but I think Martine, the mum, is so worn out after decades of dealing with this that she didn't want to actually get too much involved in the book. So she's in the book a bit, but Neri really is the key character. And Neri's been very involved in it. I interviewed her at length on numerous occasions. She's read it. She's very glad it's out. It's a memorial. It's dedicated to her. I mean, if you read the dedication, it's effectively a memorialization, right, of her dad. And it's a way that to tell, you know, I think she likes the idea that her dad is remembered in this way. He's not forgotten. You know, at Doig's trial, they as civil parties, they what they asked for was that perhaps, because Kett was a man who believed in education, and if you read the book in the beginning, you'll see that. He was a man who was passionate about learning more, and he was always exhorting his cousins, study more, and he'd buy them books, and he sent them books from Paris when he went to study there in 68. He was a man for whom education was important, and they wanted at the end of the trial, they said what would be nice is if there was a learning center near where he grew up, which is just over the Monivong Bridge here, with his name on, where there was material available for students in Khmer and in French, and of course that didn't happen, right? So there is no center there. But there is a book now, and I suppose, you know, that's, and certainly for Neri and for Martine, that is a comfort. There's copies of the books going to both of them next week, so they'll get to see it as well. And the thing is, with all of these things, it's all just too little too late. I mean, really, you look at the damage that's been done, it doesn't make any difference in many important ways. But I suppose it's something, and something is better than nothing.
That's my little problem.
I have a question. Who do you think was to blame for the atrocities of the crimes committed under the Khmer Rouge?
The leadership. I mean, ultimately, responsibility lies with them. Or lay with them, and they drove a lot of the killings. But people like Doig as well were deeply involved. I mean, Doig came up with these strings of supposed traitors that ran through all the ranks and helped to stoke the paranoia that the leaders relied on, and I think enjoyed. And you know, there's a lot of blame to go around. I mean, the people at the bottom who were doing the killing per se, the guards at Chung Ek and the others, are in many ways, I think, not as responsible as those who were driving the killings from the top. Because in that situation, if you were a guard at Chung Ek, you couldn't say to Doig, "Nah, I'm not going to do it today. I don't feel like doing this anymore. I'd like to do something else." It just wasn't a possibility. You were told to kill people. You kill people, or you would be killed as an enemy of the revolution. So the people at the bottom, I think, who were carrying out the killings, I think, of course, they are to blame in some way. And in Buddhist culture, certainly they will be punished for it in their next lives. But ultimately, the blame lies with those who drove the killings, and they were those at the top. And people in positions of power like Doig, who stoked the paranoia and kept it going, all these confessions, all these strings of supposed traitors, it never ended. Doig was asked at trial, if the Vietnamese hadn't invaded when they did, where would this have ended? And he said, who could know? I mean, even by the end, Doig thought he was going to get killed. His boss, Son Sen, had been mentioned in so many confessions as a traitor that it was probably a matter of time. But luckily for Doig, the Vietnamese invaded and he got away.
Any other questions? But do you think there should be a role played by Sihanouk at the time, because Sihanouk was the one for Cambodians to go to the factory and join the Khmer Rouge?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Sihanouk absolutely did take blame and ought to take blame on things like helping the support for the Khmer Rouge in the early 70s. But by the time, even by 1973, Sihanouk was being marginalised and was being denigrated in Khmer Rouge-controlled areas. And certainly when the Khmer Rouge took power, he had absolutely no political power whatsoever. He was lucky not to be killed. I mean, it's probably the fact he survived the Khmer Rouge period in Phnom Penh is almost certainly because China told Pol Pot, you can't kill him. And so they didn't.
Any more questions? Going once.
This, by the way, is the execution register, and Kett's name, that's not it, it's gone now. This is the confession of one of his friends. So this is out of S21, the archive. This is just to show you what some of these confessions look like, the thumbprint and all the rest.
Any others? Oh, one more, yes. Come on.
Hi, question for you. I don't know if I have read the book,
But you think that Khmer Rouge is a product or result from the doctrine, the Nixon doctrine? If it is, should be Nixon should be prosecuted?
A product of the Nixon doctrine. I'm not an American history scholar, so the Nixon doctrine is not something I'm familiar with. I mean, should people like Henry Kissinger have been put on trial for what they did in, among other countries, Cambodia? Well, absolutely. If you want to have, this goes back to what Anna was asking earlier, you're going to have a balanced political system internationally, then people who commit war crimes ought to be put on trial. And certainly Henry Kissinger and Nixon, who's dead now, of course Kissinger isn't, ought to be held accountable for what they did. I think that's absolutely fair. If you're going to have a balanced, a level playing field, then that's what you do. Whether Nixon's response for what happened in Cambodia, well, the bombing of Cambodia happened on his watch, under his orders, but he's dead now, so not much we can do about that. But I think it's broadly recognized that the US bombing of Cambodia, although debated by academics as to quite how important that was in driving support for the Khmer Rouge, was certainly, could not be argued anything other than being a war crime. I mean, how could it be anything other than that?
Right. Any last chances to buy a book? I did this man up here. He'd love to work a few extra hours, just holding back and selling Rob's book for us.
Yeah. If the book, by the way, if you don't want to buy it today, you can always buy it in Monument Books. It's on sale there. If you like digital books, it's on Kindle, on Amazon. So there's all sorts of ways of buying it. And if you don't want to buy it, that's absolutely fine too. There's no compulsion. I would encourage you to buy a drink at the bar, because MetaHouse have done an excellent job of hosting this, as they always do, actually. So thanks to MetaHouse. And briefly, a couple more thanks, by the way. Two more thanks. One to my wife, Beata, who I think is still here and hasn't left yet. Oh, there she is. Beata, for putting up with my extensive writing process over the last 5 years, I think it's been. Thank you for that. Much appreciated. I think you thought it would never come to an end, but it did. A couple of other thanks very briefly. A friend of mine, Dan, who flew in from Singapore for tonight. Another friend of mine, Laura, who came in from Bangkok. A bunch of other people. And not to forget, for this amazing cover, I should just say, and it is, I did not design this, amazing cover designed by Erica Pinheiros over here, who combined Van Nat's remarkable painting into a very great jacket and a whole look of the book, which is much appreciated. So thanks to all of you for all your input. It's much appreciated. And thanks to Monument Books, Sambo, for coming in tonight and selling. Much appreciated. Too.
Fantastic to finish on, Rob. Congratulations.
Thanks, Luke.
See you all at the bar.